Good evening. I'm Dr. Elaine Schroeder. Welcome to Mind Over Matter, a monthly K2 radio show that explores issues of the heart as well as of the mind. And in tonight's show, we'll explore the psychological and societal impacts of a lifestyle, perhaps peculiar to America, that kills hundreds of thousands of people every year. Now, what is that? I'm not talking about smoking or obesity, but rather about gun violence. The Surgeon General, the past Surgeon General, was abruptly fired by Trump in April, most likely because he insisted for years that gun violence should be classified as a public health threat. And earlier in 2014, the National Rifle Association lobbied the Senate to not confirm that very same person. The extent of our gun violence is a uniquely American disaster. Among all the developed nations in the world, the U.S. is by far the most lethal concerning homicides due to firearms. The number of gun murders per capita in the U.S. is 25 times higher than in any other developed country. So many people die every year from gunfire in the U.S. that the death toll between 1968 and 2011 eclipses all wars ever fought by our country. So are our elected officials doing something about this fear-driven epidemic? Unfortunately, not much. In February, Donald Trump signed a measure that scrapped an Obama-era regulation aimed at keeping guns out of the hands of severely mentally ill people. And that would be a legislation that I presume would be supported by the vast majority of Americans, but can't make it through Congress. So tonight, I'm really fortunate to have on my show Luann Christian, a former Junoite who now spends half the year in Washington, D.C., where she volunteers with the grassroots groups called We the People for Sensible Gun Laws. Their goal is to bring awareness to the issue of gun violence and speak out, advocating for gun safety reform. So welcome.
Thank Luann, you.
I'm so glad you will spend some time with us on your short visit to Juneau.
I am so happy to be here.
Yeah. Well, not only is it delightful to see you again, I am very interested to know how you became, what led you to become involved in gun violence issues.
Well, actually, our homegrown girl, Molly Smith, and Suzanne Blue Star Boy, after the Newtown shootings in Connecticut, where 20 young children were killed and 6 adults, Molly and Suzanne decided that they had to try to do something. So they quickly pulled together a march in Washington within a few months of this shooting, maybe even less than 2 months. It was January 17, 2013. I was not in D.C. at the time, but Molly contacted me and asked if I would help with the operations of the event. So in coming to the planning sessions and so forth and being involved in that, I met a couple of the founders of this group that I'm now associating with. But, you know, the Newtown shooting really hit me to the heart.
Could you remind us what that one was?
That was Sandy Hook.
Oh, Sandy Hook.
Right. Sandy Hook, 2013, 20 young first graders mostly, second graders, third graders, I think, were killed, 6 adults. At the time, my son was a preschool teacher, and just the image of him hiding in a closet with his kids was so powerful. And just, you know, the tragedy of the children. And when nothing happened after that shooting, I mean, we all thought that this is it. This is the wake-up call. This is the thing that is going to make America say, enough is enough. And then nothing happened. And so I decided that I was in a position to dedicate at least a portion of my life to trying to evoke change.
Okay. Thank you for doing that. Could you tell me what your group actually does?
Well, we go out in front of the White House every Monday from 11 to 1 with our signs and petitions, and basically just bring awareness to the issue with people who are passing by. And it's interesting. One of the things that's interesting in our time there, there's a couple things, but is how people from other countries see us. Because we get a lot of people passing from foreign countries. And we get a lot of foreign news wanting to interview us while we're there. We provide a photo opportunity for news media.
Yeah,
because
that's true.
They know we're there. But it's really, unfortunately, the American press is rarely present. But the foreign press is strong. And the conversations that we have with passerbys shows that people outside of America just think this gun violence epidemic is just crazy. We often get people from Australia and Britain who have dealt with it themselves in a very concrete way. But just the general street traffic is, you know,
well, that's very interesting because that really brings us into how the rest of the developed world deals with every other country, and has gun laws that change their statistics totally.
You know, in the United States, we are 4.5% of the world population, but we own 50% of all the guns that are in civilian hands. The level of guns in the United States is not duplicated anywhere else in civilized world. But we have statistics that show that more guns result in more gun violence, and yet we fail to act
right
on this issue.
And that's kind of an interesting contradiction, okay, because in one simplistic way, you could think, well, there are so many guns around, I've got to arm myself, so I've got to have a gun. So it's almost like the more guns there are, the more people are arming themselves, and the more likely it is that those guns are going to be used in a lethal manner. And not just a deliberate homicide, because we know of children who have accidentally shot their sibling or a friend.
Now, one of our members, an 11-year-old sister, accidentally killed her 9-year-old sister. No, it comes down to whether you think guns make you safer or make you less safe in society. And unfortunately, the research into gun violence has been blocked by the NRA. In 1993, research came out showing that you were less safe if you had a gun in the home. You were more likely to be a victim of gun violence. By 1996, the NRA had prevented the CDC, which is who sponsored the original study, from doing any more research into the issue. So,
how did they do that?
Lobbying Congress and getting Congress to pass restrictions on the funding of the CDC.
Isn't that phenomenal?
Yeah.
It would be like cigarette companies getting lobbying Congress, in other words, paying money to get the Surgeon General's office to stop doing research on the impacts of smoking.
Yes, yes.
Yes.
And, you know, unfortunately, we have no good statistics through the federal government, but we do have private statistics that show that you are 4.5 times more likely to be a victim of gun violence if there is a gun involved. Women are particularly at risk for gun violence. Women in abusive situations are 5 times more likely to be killed if there's a gun in the house.
And I remember when I was working at AWARE, one of the first things we did when we had a a client come in who was a victim of domestic violence is do a gun assessment to see if there were any guns in the house. And, of course, as a therapist, I would always have to do a gun assessment when I had a suicidal client. And so are you including in these statistics suicide as well as homicide?
Yeah, the death toll to gun violence in the U.S. is between 33,000 to 38,000 a year. And of those, two-thirds are suicide. And we know that if somebody attempts a suicide and is not successful, 50% of them will not go on to try again.
Yeah.
But 90% of them are successful if they have a gun. And Alaska is the number one, we have the most deaths in this state per 100,000 than any other state in the nation.
By suicide, you mean?
In any form. Alaska has the most deaths by gun.
Oh, by guns.
Per population.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Oh,
and 80% of those are suicides.
And we know we've had a suicide epidemic, and we have a gun violence epidemic, and the two of them merge, obviously. And as a therapist, I can confirm that we would have far fewer suicides if we didn't have guns all over the place, because I specialize in working with depressed adolescents, among others. And for a teenager who's going through a really bad spell, they can be impetuous. Mm-hmm. And if there is a gun around, there's no going back. That gun's going to work. And we lose a lot of kids that way.
96.5% of suicides are with guns.
So why are gun laws so politicized when it's obviously a public health issue?
Well, money, I think.
Follow
the money is the bottom line. There was a shift in the NRA. The NRA was first created to help Americans be better shots. After the war, there were a number of people that were disappointed with our shooting abilities. So that was really the inception of the NRA. And then it became more of an organization around hunters. But at some point in the fairly recent past, there was a coup, and it was pretty much taken over by the gun manufacturers and the ammunitions. You know, one thing that's interesting is we have had very little cooperation with the NRA toward any kind of sensible gun legislation or protection. And recently they've come out and said, well, maybe we could get behind bump stocks, which, you know, converts assault weapons, basically.
Whoa, what happened in Las Vegas?
Right.
That was a bump stock?
Right, right. To make it more or less an automatic, you know, weapon.
An automatic weapon.
Continue shooting.
Okay.
Well, when you look at it, the manufacturing of bump stocks is not made by the gun manufacturers. It's an independent addition to the guns. So, yes, they're willing to maybe look at that a little bit, or maybe it's just a stalling tactic. But, you know, there's no real change.
It doesn't hurt the armament manufacturers, the gun manufacturers,
right.
Bottom line.
Right.
So that is very interesting.
Right. And
yeah.
Legislators are afraid of being primaried out if they're not 100% AAA on any issue on the NRA. And that is why we need to be vocal. We need to say, this is an epidemic. This is an epidemic that we need to start to focus on, just like we did in anything else.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we lose 33,000 people or more a year to gun violence, and yet we don't address it.
And let's talk about this later, but we also are living in a state of perpetual anxiety. And this sounds terrible, loss of life, that everybody in this country, and particularly people in cities, although now, because it's so random when there's these mass shootings, and obviously suicide can happen anywhere, no matter where you are.
The psychological effects of fear that are being perpetuated are very serious. And, you know, when you look at mass murders are actually a very small amount of the gun violence, the gun deaths in the U.S. But they have tripled since 2011. They've become more and more serious. I mean, and when I first got involved, my group first got started when the Colorado movie theater shooting in Aurora, and 12 people were killed. Yeah. And then Sandy Hook, 20 people. And then you had the Pulse nightclub shooting where 49 people, and now Las Vegas, 59 people and 500 wounded. And then not only is it that we are becoming deadlier, but we are also becoming more random. I mean, to the point where you want to go to a concert, you want to go to a movie theater, you want to go send your child to school, and you have to question, am I safe? Is my child safe? I mean, we have spent since Sandy Hook over $800 million just on school safety. The school safety industry now is a $5 billion industry. We're making bulletproof backpacks for our kids. You know, the time where you could send your kid off to play and just not worry about it. So even though it's a small impact, it's as far as the numbers of deaths, it's a huge impact in the psychological well-being of every American.
Also, there are structures put in place. I remember the days when you could walk into the federal building like a normal person.
Right.
And now probably every federal building in the United States, you have to go through security. It turns us into the security state, not because of so-called terrorism, but because it could be one because of gun violence.
Right. And if terrorism is really the concern, we've had more deaths by toddlers than terrorists in the U.S. And the other thing is
You mean gun deaths?
Gun deaths, yes. And we have not yet restricted people on the no-fly terrorist list from being able to purchase guns. So we're not...
There's a disconnect there.
Right. And the other thing about the mass shootings is that 54% of them are domestic violence related. And that's an issue that is becoming more and more of a problem. 1 million women have been shot or shot at. 4.5 million women have been threatened with a gun. And we have one of the things that we could do to reduce gun violence is to protect women from domestic abusers from getting a gun. And right now, if you had been married or had a legal contraction as lived or have children with an abuser, they would not be able to get a gun. But if it's just a boyfriend, there's a loophole, and they would not be restricted, even if you have a restraining order out on them from obtaining a gun.
Well, it just really impresses me the cost of living, all of us living in fear, the kind of fear you don't live in any other developed country. Not to say there are not shootings, but it is about the frequency and the proportion and the likelihood. And, of course, we know the statistics, and we know that. Did you see the Michael Moore film, Bowling for Columbine?
I did. Been quite a while, but yes.
Well, Michael Moore grew up in Detroit, and so what he did, I mean, he is such a funny guy. Right across from Detroit, the Canadian city, and I'm trying to remember the name of it, he compared the two, and we all know the reputation of Detroit as being a very, very poor and violent city. So right across the border, he was walking around, and he was saying... He was knocking on doors, and he was saying, do you lock your door? And I go, no, I don't lock my door. And go from door to door in these working-class neighborhoods, and nobody locked their door, which reminded me of Juneau, where for years and years we never locked our door. Only because of the opioid epidemic are we starting to do so, interestingly. Okay. And living in Canada, and we have a cottage in Atlin, and I talk to people about gun violence, and like you experienced when you were having your vigil outside the White House. Our Canadian friends, they feel so sorry for us. Not only do we not have good health care that is available for all people equally, but we're living in the state of perpetual fear from guns.
And our foreign visitors feel that themselves. I've had several people comment to me how they are concerned traveling in the U.S. You know, and it's the whole way of our life. I mean, if you're on a lonely road and your car breaks down and you go up to a house to knock for help, nowadays you have to be considered, especially if you're a minority, that how can I present myself to let them know I'm non-threatening so that they don't shoot me before I have a chance to tell them that all I want is help for my car? Or if you have somebody following you and you're walking down a street and you're afraid that they might be, you know, thinking of assaulting you, if you go to help at a random stranger's, they might perceive you as a threat. And then there's car rage, you know, the deaths of people that are occurring because some kids are playing loud music in the car behind them. And
car rage.
They take that as threatening, and, you know, all of a sudden they're into a rage and they're shooting. Or you're driving and you inadvertently cut somebody off and suddenly they're starting to shoot at you with a gun. So it's really starting to permeate throughout all of our consciousness.
Well, also, because there are these, as you called them, random locations for these things to happen. It could be a daycare center. It could be a movie theater. It could be a concert. It could be a high school. It could be anywhere. For particularly, I'd say, for those who are sensitive to, who tend to be on the anxious side, what you're doing is creating mini traumas for all these people.
Yeah.
Who wouldn't think say after the shooting at the country music concert in Las Vegas, if I were going to a country music or a jazz festival or anything like that right afterwards, I'd be anxious. So it's no wonder.
Well, we have to start to ask ourselves, what is the cost of this to the greater society? We have people who really believe strongly in their ownership of a gun. And I understand that. I actually grew up shooting at the NRA rifle range in Virginia.
Really?
It was the thing that I did with my father from the time I was 10 until I discovered boys at about 13. And, you know, we didn't go every weekend, but we went a lot. And I was a sharpshooter, marksman, I can't remember. I have the little certificates at home. But anyway, the point is that I get that guns make you feel powerful and they're fun, but we have to balance the cost to all of us. We recognize there is a Second Amendment that has been interpreted, maybe not the way I would like to see interpreted, but guns aren't going to go away. We have too many. We have 310 million guns in the society. So obviously we're not going to be able, even with a sophisticated buyback program, to get rid of guns. But there are things that we can do to make ourselves safer. And we have to get into a climate where we, as a society, are starting to demand that we have an equal right. You know, the Second Amendment says that we have a well-regulated militia, well-regulated. And that's been de-emphasized. But even Scalia in the Heller decision said that, like, and I'm going to quote now, like most rights, the right secured by the Second Amendment is not unlimited. It's not a right to carry, keep and carry any weapon whatsoever in any manner whatsoever and for whatever purpose. You know, our constitutional rights are not all or nothing. We can uphold the Second Amendment and still pass reasonable regulations that further public interests for safety. But we have to be active. The reason why nothing has been done for so long is because Congress has been blocked from doing anything by the fear of losing their positions.
You mean, so in other words, again, follow the money, that the NRIA, which would be essentially a front group mm-hmm. for gun manufacturers, is spending a lot of money making this a social issue when it's a public health issue. Luann, I think this is time, because we've been giving our listeners quite a bit of information, and I think they need a break. So let's have some gentle music. And so what we'll do is come back in a few minutes, and we'll continue our discussion about the social, and then let's bring up the economic costs of gun violence. Welcome back to Mind Over Matter. I'm Dr. Elaine Schroeder, and with me in the studio tonight is Luann Christian, who volunteers in Washington, D.C. with the grassroots group called We the People for Sensible Gun Laws. And we have begun to talk about gun safety reform. Luann, I have a question for you. A lot of times, though, an issue can be a human issue.
Right.
Economic arguments are made to, for example, with climate change. Climate change is obviously a scientific issue, but people love to talk about when they're in favor of mitigating climate change, they talk about the economic benefits of doing so. So what's the financial cost of this problem?
Yeah, that's an aspect that's really not spoken about very much, but it really impacts all of us. I mean, as an average, the average American, every American, it's costing them about $700 to $1,200 a year in terms of costs associated with gun violence. The direct costs are $8.6 billion a year. And just the hospital costs are $5.4 billion a year. But when you total it all up, we're looking at an impact to our economy of $229 billion a year. And that's, you know, prison costs, prosecution costs, lost incomes, so forth, so forth. But I want to go back to the aspect of, do guns make you safer?
Okay.
Because it was something just happened on November 1st, I think it was, in Colorado. There was a shooting in Walmart. And there were several shoppers who also had weapons on them who took out their concealed weapons when the shooting happened, ostensibly to protect themselves. Nobody actually engaged with the shooter, so there was no shots fired by any of the bystanders. But when the police came in to try to identify who the shooter was and to be able to track him out the store, it delayed the police by 5 hours while the man escaped. At this point, I don't know that he's been caught. I haven't heard any updates on that. But the fact was, the police had to go through the video to look to see. And I know when Gabby Giffords was shot that there were other people with guns in the crowd that didn't use them. There was one man who just barely missed shooting somebody who was actually not a shooter. Uh-huh. But, you know, that's one thing. But people, when we're on the street, it's very interesting to hear what their fears are, what they're concerned about. And many of them say, I need to be able to protect my family. And I applaud that. We all want to protect our families. But the reality is, first of all, your chance of being a victim of a home invasion is less than zero. Or it's not less than zero. It's basically zero. But if you put the decimal point and add 7 zeros out and then put a 2, that's your percentage. The percentage of guns used in self-defense is less than 1%. So we are paying a very high societal cost to our sense of well-being, the way society is changing, and our feeling of safety, and also fear, because fear separates us. And I think that's something that we have to start to weigh what we will demand of our
society. What it does to us socially. Luann, what do you think the very serious problem of police violence, particularly against black males? Can you, you know, connect the dots on that? And I would say it would be under the heading of trigger happy. In other words, a police officer, a well-meaning, decent human being, does not know if his suspect has a gun. Whereas if we were in Canada or the UK, they'd know there was hardly any chance in the world that the suspect had a gun. So it makes sense that police are going to be very, very nervous because a lot of their suspects are going to be armed.
Since 2014, with Ferguson happened with Michael Brown, which we've heard about a lot, to May 2017, there were 2,900 cases of police shootings. Not all of those were not legitimate.
Right.
I mean, there's not a breakdown. But definitely, a policeman has to consider the fact that anyone that he might encounter might turn on him with a gun. And with our inherent racism in this society, that is just multiplied. So, yes, definitely. There are statistics that I don't have off the top of my head of the amount of shootings. We had somebody come to by us in the White House from Britain not long ago, and he was saying something like, you know, all the shootings in Britain over the last 50 years are less than what we have in a month or something.
I mean, he knew that.
Yeah, he had the statistics, and I wouldn't to the audience say that that's a hardcore statistic.
Right.
But the fact is that they don't have the same problems in Britain or Australia, in areas that have addressed their gun controls and gun violence issues.
Well, I'm thinking of the Harvard professor, the black Harvard professor, who was fumbling for a key to get into his own house, who then was manhandled and arrested by police. And so I think of Ta-Nehisi Coates, the incredible author whose recent, probably Pulitzer Prize-winning book, I think, which is a letter to his son about what it is like for a black male growing up in this country with so many lethal, trigger-happy people who make a stereotype or would assume that a black person is a threat.
This is a public health issue. I want to say again and again, it affects all Americans. We, you know, we can look at minorities are much more affected by this when it comes to police shootings or even being homicide victims. But the biggest at-risk group from suicide is shifting now to be adult white men. It used to be more adolescents, and still children are more likely to be involved in accidents than any other group, accidental shootings.
Mm-hmm.
But at this point, white men are the most at-risk population to suicide.
So that's very interesting.
And that's a recent shift.
Yes, yes. What can we do about it?
Well, the first thing we need to do is to be vocal, to decide as a society that it's not acceptable, that we're not going to be numb to it, that we're not going to let go of our rights for safety and the pursuit of happiness as given to us in the Declaration of Independence, to just for this one other right. I mean, regulated cars, and I know we don't have a constitutional right to own cars, but we looked at cars as a potentially dangerous agency in society. And we said, okay, we need to license them, we need to require education, we need to have regulations, you need to drive along in this narrow path, and keep to the lanes. We accept those restrictions because we recognize that without them, we are at danger.
Mm-hmm.
Having guns in society is no difference. So the first thing is to be vocal, to call your legislators, to email, to let people know, to talk to your neighbors, to tell them, this is a concern, I care about this, to not just ignore it. Because when you're under assault, which we kind of are now, you know, from the fear of gun violence, if nothing else, it's easy to just kind of shrink up and and go into our own little cocoons and not break out and speak out and say, no, I demand change. So that's number one. And then the next thing we can do is we can look at background checks. We can tighten background checks. We can tighten the boyfriend loophole that allows domestic abusers to obtain weapons, even if there's a protective order out for them. We can also look at gun safety. I mean, 1.69 million, so one in 1.69 million kids live in households that have guns.
Mm-hmm.
And we need to make sure that people lock up their guns, they separate their ammunition, and they lock it up. We need to have classes for gun safety.
Yeah. Just like for driving a car, you have to get a license. You have to learn how to obey the rules of the road. And so, as I understand it, in Canada, in order to own a firearm, you have to take a gun safety class. And that would, you know, go on, talk about having gun safes and making sure that guns are locked up, and keeping ammunition separate from the firearm. And those obvious things that people may not think of.
Basically, demand responsible gun ownership.
Well, Luann, what do we do? Don't we need campaign finance reform in order to do this? Because, as you yourself said, it's the gun lobby, it's the follow the money, it's the gun makers, the gun manufacturers. I mean, that's one small industry. How can they control so much?
It would certainly help, but really, it's not. I mean, the money is definitely a part of it.
Uh-huh.
That is definitely a large part of it, because it gives them the ability to put in massive ads. If a legislator mm-hmm. is running and he's not been, you know, if he's even hinted at any kind of gun regulation, he'll be targeted with very expensive ads. But it's also their grassroots operation where the NRA can go to their membership and say, call on this legislator or that legislator and threaten, you know, a primary or vote for this person or that person. So if we can become heard, then we can have the same kind of effect. The other thing that I think that we're ready to talk about as a society is, where's the place for military-styled weapons in our society? What are we giving up for some people who want to have the access to assault rifles or semi, you know, automatic or large capacity magazines to feel powerful, to be able to, shoot at a range? What are the rest of us giving up? Because they're not the weapons that are used for hunting.
No.
You wouldn't be able to eat the meat
right.
if that was the case. And the other thing is that these are not weapons that our founding fathers could have even fathomed. These were not the kind of weapons that were intended to be protected under the Second Amendment.
Yes. Luann, is it possible at a municipal or a state level to change gun laws? Can people start closer to home than the federal level?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, I am not an expert on the issue, but I do know that part of the way that the Second Amendment was reinterpreted during the Heller decision was case law being created in some of the conservative states that have the largest gun ownership. And that case law was used to build the case to soften our interpretation of the Second Amendment.
So are there any states or municipalities that have forward-thinking gun laws?
I'm not real well-versed in that, but I can tell you that Massachusetts just passed a law prohibiting the bump stocks. And get on board, the rest of the world.
Super. Okay, let's take another short break. And I am, just to remind our listeners that I'm Dr. Elaine Schroeder, and Luann, Christian, and I will be right back to talk some more about the efforts that her gun safety group and other advocates are making to stop America from being by far the most gun violent among developed countries. We'll be right back. Back to Mind Over Matter. I'm Dr. Elaine Schroeder, and with me in the studio tonight is Luann Christian, a gun law reform advocate. And we have been talking about the high social and economic cost of loose gun laws, if there are any, and gun violence in the United States. And Luann, we have a few minutes left on the program. What would you like to highlight?
Well, we can finish talking a little bit about some of the things that might help to reduce gun violence. That would be a starting point. We've talked about background checks and tightening background checks. We still lose about 40% of all sales are not through a background check. We also have the loopholes to the boyfriend, domestic violence abusers that we can tighten up. And we've talked about the looking at whether or not it would make sense to ban and have a buyback program for our assault weapons and large capacity magazines. In addition to that, we need to demand research. I mean, that's probably the thing that most people can get behind.
Yeah.
You know, after background checks, that's a pretty popular thought in America.
Mm-hmm.
But we don't have enough research to really bring people to understand that guns don't make us safer, because that is a motivating factor for many people who own guns. You know, in my time in front of the White House, I talk to all kinds of people. And there's often people who are gun supporters or, you know, gun rights advocates. And when you drill down to them, it often comes out that what they're most afraid of, or they feel they have to have a gun for, is to protect themselves from the government.
Oh.
And that is not something that I can really dissuade them from easily. I mean, I can point out that the government has access to drones and heavy armament, but that's kind of an irrational fear, I think, and not, I don't believe, was the intention of the Second Amendment to create an army to overthrow itself.
Mm-hmm.
But beyond that, the next one is to protect their family. And we have so many statistics that show that you're at higher risk for suicide, you're at higher risk for domestic violence death, higher risk for homicide if you have guns. But the research is sketchy, so we need to demand from our legislatures that we allow the CDC, not just allow it, but insist that the CDC present us with real information. I know we're becoming a factless society, but we need to take that back. We need to be able to have somebody we trust that can help direct the conversation.
What do you think the chances of doing that under a Trump administration that in and of itself promotes violence? Have things changed for you? You've been doing your volunteer work for quite some time, well before Trump.
Right.
So how do things change now?
Well, I think there's little to no chance of things happening on the federal level. I think we are very much have to be a grassroots level at this point, and we have to insist from the grassroots up. It's been interesting. There has been a definite atmospheric shift with the new administration. In the 3 years that I was in front of the White House during the Obama administration, people would come by and they would stop and they would talk. And we would often have people who disagreed with us very strongly. But now, just physically, it's very different because the administration has pushed the boundaries of where you can be in front of the White House back. They've blocked parks and they've put up barriers. And
I hear they closed Lafayette Park.
Lafayette Park. After the inauguration, it did not reopen for months, unlike other previous administrations where it was quickly reopened. And it was open for a short time and then it was closed again. And Lafayette Park, for people who don't know, is a park that's right in front of the White House. It's now closed again. They say that they are doing work on the park. I'm down there every Monday, and you see almost nothing done. And the few things that are being done are not things that couldn't be done while passers were going by. But it's very common to be down there and have Secret Service come out in force and push us further, even on the other side of the park. So there's that. But beyond that, the dialogue, I'd never had somebody spit in my face before. I'd never had the kind...
Somebody spit in your face?
Yes. And I've not had the kind of ugly shouting, just the tone has shifted. It has, for whatever reason, made people feel emboldened to act in their worst self. And, it's interesting because one of my major focuses in doing this work is to try to find a way to communicate with each other. And I noticed early on, before I knew much, and I was just following my other friends that were there, if somebody came in and wanted to argue with us, that my voice would go up and I would get, talking in a loud voice I realized that I had to stop and I had to step away and I had to think about what connects us. What do we agree on?
Yeah.
Because if someone thinks that all we want to do is take their guns away, they can't hear anything.
Right.
And what we want to do is to convince people that we can find common ground to make all Americans safer and that we have just as much right to a well-regulated militia as they do to the right to bear arms.
Well, I really applaud what you're doing because you're engaging in nonviolent communication. You're actually role modeling that and by standing every, dedicating your Mondays, how long do you stay there in front of the White House? How long do you stand?
It's 2 hours, 11 uh-huh. to 1, which yeah. sometimes goes very quickly and sometimes goes very long.
Well, I really commend you for doing that. And also, I want to thank you, Luann, as our program draws to a close, for spending your precious hours during your visit to Juneau here in the studio, talking about something that is really, really passionate, you're passionate about, and is so important. So thank you for coming in, and thank you for volunteering your time to reduce gun violence and the enormous suffering it brings with it. And I'd also like to thank John Kremers for supporting this program and the dozens of other programs that he has volunteered to do the engineering for over the many years that we've had Mind Over Matter. So thank you, John, for coming in. And, of course, thanks to our listeners for tuning in. Please join us for another edition of Mind Over Matter on another Monday evening next month. Good night.